Hello, hello. Welcome back to season two of the Leadership Podcast. I'm so happy you're here. This episode is going to be my last episode of 2022, which is just absolutely insane to think about. So I wanted to say thank you for your listens and thank you for your feedback on season two so far, and to just say that I'm so excited for what the new year has in store. So huge thank you, everyone. And now, let's get into this episode. The topic I want to consider today is cervical cancer, specifically screening methods for cervical cancer, and what role artificial intelligence could have in cancer screening. And I know it's a pretty specific topic, but it's one that I've been interested in for over a year now. And I thought I would talk about it because it's kind of the perfect thing to spend an episode on. Since, spoiler alert, I actually wrote a pretty extensive research paper on this topic last year, but I've tried my best to just hit the highlights and the main ideas with this episode so I don't get too bogged down in the details, but there are more details, so if anyone's interested after listening, just let me know. But mainly, I'm just not getting too bogged down in the policy side, and I'm just talking more about the issues, but if you're interested in what policy impacts and changes that I propose for all these issues, just let me know and I'd be happy to chat with you about it. So let's start by talking about the actual illness or disease of cervical cancer, and I'll just throw some stats at you really quickly. So cervical cancer is the fourth most common cancer in women worldwide. And the World Health Organization says that in 2018 alone, over 570,000 women were diagnosed with cervical cancer. So that's not just how many people have it, that's the number of diagnoses that were made in 2018. More stats, over 85% of the 118,000 deaths due to cervical cancer in 2018 occurred in low-income countries. I know that was kind of confusing, but so 118,000 people died of cervical cancer in 2018, and 85% of those were in low-income countries. So not only is cervical cancer a huge issue in women's health, but it's also a disease that's born out of some really deeply rooted health disparities, therefore affecting low-income countries much heavier. So another stat, in fact, in low-income nations, the mortality rate for cervical cancer is 2.5 times higher than the rest of the world. And so, like many other health disparities, there are many factors contributing to this one. Just think about the episode that I did on maternal mortality and how many explanations and factors that were considered there. But with sicknesses like cancer, where catching it early is so crucial to the outcome, a huge cause of fatality is lack of access to cancer screening for at-risk populations. And when I say at risk, I'm talking about populations affected by factors such as low HPV vaccination rates or high rates of unprotected sexual activity or structural inequality and poverty, and of course, social inequalities like racism. And since early detection is so important to effective medical treatment, women who aren't able to get screened regularly are at much higher risks for bad outcomes. So to be clear, in addition to the well-known social determinants that put poor women, women of color, unvaccinated women at a higher risk for bad cancer outcomes, there's also the much more specific reason of living in a low-income country that lacks the healthcare infrastructure to provide them with regular screenings. And so without regular screenings, they're more likely to be diagnosed once the cancer gets much, much worse instead of in an early stage. Now, something that's gotten all of us talking lately is artificial intelligence, or AI. And we all have some idea of what AI is. But it's basically, and this is in really simple terms, a technology that mimics the human brain through different kinds of complex computing softwares and it scans and analyzes and solves problems in a simulation of cognitive function. So then one of its most useful applications is in data analysis, and researchers are beginning to apply this function in medical settings. Specifically, they're using deep learning technology, which I don't know much about, but it's a form of machine learning through which machines draw conclusions based on previous experiences. So, with this kind of technology, AI softwares can basically make deductions from data that can eventually lead to a medical diagnosis, theoretically. Now, of course, there's so much room for error, and a diagnosis rarely relies on few enough factors for a machine to be able to draw those kind of conclusions. So it can realistically best be used in a yes or no type of situation where really, really specific factors can conclude whether or not a disease is present. And so that's what I mean when I say diagnostic capability for AI software. So a lot of AI softwares are being developed to screen for cancer, to answer the question of does the sample or image or biopsy, whatever it is, does it show signs of cancer or not? And for cervical cancer, there are a lot of new technologies being created to use whole slide images from cervical cell samples to scan for signs of cancer. So they pinpoint individual cells in the images and classify each one as normal or abnormal, and then use those classifications to make a diagnosis. And I think it's the coolest thing. Two of the systems that I've read about were actually shown to make faster diagnosis than the average cytologist, which is the word they use for people who read cell samples usually. And those models were actually also demonstrated to be more accurate than the average cytologist. Now, I'm not entirely sure how they measured this, so let's leave room for skepticism. But it's still a pretty exciting step forward for AI screening methods. And there's other benefits too. The softwares require less resources to make their diagnosis, including fewer cell samples, for one, and fewer testing materials and less energy. And it's very cutting edge, so there's a lot more research to be done, for sure, and a lot more testing to be performed on these softwares before they could realistically be used. But it's really exciting, and I'm excited about this kind of research. Also, side note, I really hope nobody's counting how many times I say things are exciting. Like, we get it, you're excited. Anyway, like I mentioned, having accessible and regular screening is incredibly important for creating good outcomes for cervical cancer diagnoses, and early detection is so important for survival. And a lot of research has been done that indicates that improving screening methods and screening accessibility in areas of the world with disparities in cervical cancer outcomes is an important factor in addressing the disparities. So, what are current screening methods for cervical cancer? Well, we know about the Pap smear, or the Pap test, as others call it. It's where they basically use a large Q-tip and get a sample of cells from the cervix that they then test for any abnormalities. And if anyone didn't know, it's recommended to begin regular Pap smears at age 21, every 3-ish years if you're sexually active or at risk for HPV, which is a virus that's been directly linked to inducing cervical cancer. However, in many of these disproportionately affected areas, such as low-income countries, women often lack access to regular screenings due to the time and resources that it takes to go to a healthcare facility and get a Pap test, and the cost of the test itself, both for the healthcare facilities providing them, as well as the potential cost for the women themselves, and just overall lack of testing materials. So, low-income areas around the world tend to lack reproductive health infrastructure, including widespread clinics and the physical resources necessary for testing procedures. And this means that in areas where reproductive health care is under-resourced, cervical cancer is often not detected until it's progressed into its really late stages, causing, like I said, the mortality rate to then be really disproportionately high. Secondly, existing social inequities and other social determinants of health contribute to the reproductive health of these communities. So women of color, poor women, members of the LGBTQ plus community, and members of other disadvantaged groups are less likely to have full access to reproductive health services, largely due to bias against these aspects of their identities. And that's actually an area where AI-based screening is proposed to be beneficial because the software analyzes images of cells and can't really demonstrate discriminatory tendencies or biases, as there's no discernible difference between the cervical cells of women of different identities. Now, of course, a lot of technology has shown biases, but so far, this type has proved to be promising, and I hope that it stays that way. Okay, so we've established that AI-based screening does not require as many materials or resources as current screening methods, and it doesn't require the same widespread laboratories and facilities. So this does make AI-based cancer screening really appealing. It can lower costs, it can speed up the process, and potentially make screening for cervical cancer much more accessible. So a lot of thought has been going into lately the ways that AI screening can streamline the diagnostic process and be a real force for change in the public health space. But of course, it's never that simple, is it? So now that I've gotten very excited about the potential benefits of this technology, let's bring ourselves back to reality a bit with all of the potential ways that it can go wrong. And first, let me get out of the way the obvious one. Of course, many would argue that a software cannot accomplish what the human brain can, and we definitely shouldn't trust a software to do that yet, just putting that out there. But on a more policy and infrastructure-based level, we know that biomedical technology alone does not effectively solve public health issues. So the central question here is who will actually benefit from AI screening? Women in areas with poor reproductive health and lack of resources are unlikely to benefit from AI-based cervical cancer screening, unless, of course, new policies were implemented, but in the current state of the world. Because, for one, while AI-based cervical cancer screening requires less resources than current methods, it still needs a level of technological infrastructure in order to be effective. And when I say that, I'm talking about components like stable internet connection for communication and high camera quality for cellular images that are inputted, and digital medical records and computers with processing systems that are capable of running the software in the first place. And most areas of the world that already possess this infrastructure are the same areas with higher reproductive healthcare success rates. So if AI-based screening is only used in the areas already equipped to support this technology, it won't benefit the people who need it the most. And if anything, it would only exacerbate the divide in reproductive health as wealthy areas continue to implement new technologies and leave the rest of the world behind. So we at least need programs of some sort to bolster technological infrastructure in areas of the world where it's necessary to help them effectively use AI-based screening software. And in addition, powerful nations are likely to monopolize the technology when they realize its benefits. And I say this because empirically, wealthy nations have influenced the distribution of new healthcare treatments and taken complete control of their implementation globally, usually compelled by self-interest and usually disregarding any responsibility to the rest of the world. Countries have acted this way in the past. We saw it with COVID-19 vaccine distribution. We saw some pretty selfish hoarding, for lack of a better word, of COVID vaccines from wealthy countries who were hit less hard by COVID in the first place. And this pattern of behavior would most likely happen again. While AI technology could make screening more accessible in communities that lack regular screening resources. Other communities may buy up the technology out of desire for convenience, even if they already possess enough resources for safe and regular screening. And then companies producing the software could also take advantage of the situation, raising prices, selling to the most eager buyers. We know that in global health, corporate self-regulation can be really ineffective and difficult to enforce. The classic example is the tobacco industry, where corporations are driven by self-interest and profit, and they can influence global health policy to ensure that they benefit in the end. If you've heard about the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control or about food and sugary drink companies, we've seen that companies will create a seat at the global health negotiation table for themselves so that they can ensure they benefit from whatever policies happen to regulate them. So who's to say this won't happen again with tech companies if AI screening becomes commonly used? Just another consideration. And of course, technology is bound to break at some point. So maintenance and quality control also rely on technological infrastructure, which goes back to what I was saying earlier about countries without this infrastructure not being able to benefit from AI cancer screening. There's also considerations like training for malfunction repair and plans for any cybersecurity threats and accuracy regulation and other general software maintenance that I don't know enough about, but that I think would really complicate the implementation of the software. And there's also this idea of redistributing resources and adjusting people's medical training, since they'll no longer be performing a large volume of tests or reading a large density of scans. Their distribution of resources would need to be restructured accordingly, which takes time and foresight. And their training would have to include a baseline of things like ethical AI use and AI software troubleshooting and all of that in order to protect the personal information of patients and help avoid the pitfalls of a heavy reliance on AI-based screening methods. So that kind of balance would need to be figured out. And multi-layered troubleshooting mechanisms would need to include both software technicians and experts, as well as medical professionals, which is probably a pretty intense and complicated adjustment to make, but one that's probably going to have to happen, or at least people are going to have to consider it as we go forward with health tech. Now, let me just say that I'm not trying to be a pessimist at all about this. These are just the kinds of global health policy questions that get me thinking. And I think we can all agree that all women have a right to the highest attainable standard of health and that all women deserve access to high quality reproductive health care. So powerful innovation really is occurring in technology-based cervical cancer diagnosis and across different fields. But it's important to realize that it's probably not going to be as simple to implement as we may hope. And to really be a step in the right direction, AI-based cervical cancer screening software must really bridge existing inequalities instead of exacerbate them. And it's important that we preemptively ensure that AI-based cervical cancer screening software is employed both effectively and equitably worldwide, so that it actually benefits those who need it the most. All right, I hope you enjoyed thinking through all of that with me. If you're curious at all, my proposed solution to some of these issues began with an update to the World Health Organization's guidelines surrounding cervical cancer and technology, but it is clear that multi-level changes would need to be in order if we want to really take advantage of this kind of technology. And I'd love to know what you guys are thinking at this point, so please reach out with your comments. And with that, I'm going to sign off for 2022. Thanks for an amazing year, Thank you for listening and supporting and engaging with all of my thoughts and questions. So stay safe, and I will see you all in the new year.